Hi, and welcome to SpondyCast, where we bring together the best medical minds, thought leaders, scientists, patients, and caregivers to inform and inspire the spondylitis community. I'm your host, Jill Miller, living my best spa life, knowing that how we meet today has the power to change everything going forward. Please note that the information provided in this podcast should not be considered medical advice. We do encourage all listeners to consult their healthcare professionals for medical concerns. Thank you for listening, and we hope you find our discussion today enlightening. Hi, and welcome to SpondyCast. Today, we're going to learn about navigating menopause with spondyloarthritis, managing symptoms, and maintaining health. Our guest today is Dr. Camille Moreno. She is an assistant professor in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at the University of Utah School of Medicine. She also serves as the medical director for the Midlife Women's Health and Menopausal Medicine Program. She is a board-certified family medicine physician who pursued a fellowship in specialized women's health that focused on midlife women's healthcare. Her special interests include menopause, perimenopause, menopausal hormone therapy, non-hormonal treatment options for vasomotor symptoms of menopause, bone health, cardiometabolic health changes in midlife, sexual health, and female sexual dysfunction, as well as vulvar disorders. Dr. Moreno, welcome to SpondyCast. I said this is a very exciting one for a lot of us.
Thank you so much, Jill. That was such a kind introduction. I'm very excited to be here with you and your audience today and just talk about midlife women's health and what that entails.
Yeah, it's a hot topic, right? And I think we're finally starting to talk about it as a generation, maybe. But tell us a little bit about your work, but also why you got into this work.
Yes. So my background, actually, so I'm a family medicine physician by training. And as you mentioned, I completed a 2-year women's health fellowship that really focused on menopause and midlife women's healthcare in particular. So my focus clinical practice here out in Salt Lake City, Utah, includes treating, you know, menopausal symptoms as well as menopause-related disorders, including bone health, sexual wellness, breast cancer risk, and cardiovascular disease risk assessment. And really what got me into the position that I'm in today is when I was a family medicine resident, so I was in Ohio back then, I really didn't address symptoms of menopause very well and not very confidently either. I was even afraid of prescribing vaginal estrogen formulations for one, vaginal dryness and other related symptoms with menopause and the genitourinary system. And so I had this, you know, desire and passion to expand my knowledge and really expand my training in women's health, but in particular, menopause care. And so my career here as an academic clinician in Utah is divided into clinical care. So that's majority of my time, but I also do some teaching and some community outreach as well as research. And like what you mentioned earlier, I also serve as the medical director for University of Utah Midlife Women's Health and Menopause Medicine Program. So I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, you're a busy lady. Where in Ohio, if I might ask?
Yeah, so I was in Columbus. Central Ohio. I was at The Ohio State. And so go Bucks. And family medicine residencies are for 3 years, actually. And so it really encompasses a breadth of, you know, training, including pediatrics, men's health, women's health, geriatric care, sports medicine. And so we really are the jack of all trades when it comes to community medicine. But I did feel like there was a strong educational gap in my training and when it came to menopause care. And so I looked for programs within the country to explore my options and how I can get into the in-depth training and also provide, you know, the skill set and the services that I can provide for midlife women.
Amazing. Let's talk a little bit about menopause can last for a very long time.
Sure.
And there's, right, three basic states, I guess. So peri, actual menopause and then postmenopause. What does that look like on a timeline, and what do those transitions look like for women?
Yeah. So this is a good place to start, because this will serve as the basic foundation for perimenopause and menopause education for your listeners. So you are absolutely right that there are three stages of midlife. So it starts actually in perimenopause. And this is the transition period leading up to a woman's last menstrual period. And we actually know perimenopause as the most symptomatic phase in a woman's life. So this is where, yes, the cluster of symptoms that women feel even when they're still menstruating and having cycles truly is prevalent. And this can last anywhere between 7 to 10 years. And so it's a very long time for women to endure the cluster of symptoms that they're experiencing. I tell my patients out here that it's not just a weekend thing. It just doesn't last for a few days. And then all of a sudden you feel great, you feel better. So this can be a process that can last for close to a decade. And then menopause happens, right? And then this is more of what we call a clinical diagnosis. And so this is truly one defined as 12 consecutive months or one full year of no menstrual bleeding. And so symptoms may start to become more noticeable. And these are your classic, you know, hot flashes, night sweats, sleep interruptions. But also the not so classic ones like mood swings, brain fog, lack of focus, right? Joint pain, which you don't normally hear about that's related to menopause, can start becoming more noticeable. And so then the last stage of midlife happens, and that is postmenopause. And this refers to the 1 year after a woman's last menstrual period and the stage that goes on for the rest of her life. And hormonal levels start to level off in postmenopause, and symptoms do become less intense and less frequent, and hopefully to none, right? So, but this takes time. And so I would say that in your postmenopausal years, majority of women will end up with less frequent symptoms. Hopefully they may not experience the hot flashes and night sweats anymore, but there's still about 22 to 27%, according to studies that we know, where women are considered to be super flashers. So these symptoms may not actually go away, including those typical hot flashes, night sweats that I mentioned earlier.
Oh,
I know. But I would say that there's still that light at the end of the tunnel. We'll experience less symptoms in their post-years.
So you were talking about the clusters of symptoms and syndromes, which is what they have put forward here. So what are those, like, did we cover all of those, and will they affect someone like with spondyloarthritis or other immune or inflammatory diseases differently?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this can be very individually dependent, right? So not one woman goes through the same perimenopause and menopause journey. And this actually applies more in women who have autoimmune conditions such as spondyloarthritis. So we also know from studies and from data that women with spondyloarthritis, menopause symptoms can actually be worse, right? Because of that drop in estrogen levels leading to more inflammation. And typically when there's more inflammation in the body, this can potentially lead to more severe joint pain that can really be debilitating. It can affect your quality of life, like your mood and your sleep habits, and maybe even your work productivity. And also with that, more inflammation in the body can also increase gastrointestinal changes or gut changes like abdominal bloating, indigestion, or upset stomach. I commonly hear about constipation. And the reason for that is there are estrogen receptors that are found ubiquitously, so from head to toe. So it's not just, you know, receptors that are found in our reproductive organs like our ovaries, our uterus, our breasts, But estrogen can be found in our brain, specifically our neurotransmitters, our retina, our inner ears, or eyes, or muscles, or bones have estrogen receptors as well. And so women with autoimmune conditions tend to present with the cluster that you mentioned earlier. And so that's important to know specifically in this type of menopause kind of care with when it comes to autoimmune conditions. And I keep mentioning chronic inflammation with spondyloarthritis, but that is specific really to all, you know, connective tissue disorders and autoimmune conditions that affect women predominantly. And when there's also more inflammation, the risk for what we call cardiometabolic health changes increase among women. So what this includes is insulin resistance, higher blood pressure, cholesterol changes, which, as you know, and may have figured out, are all really risk factors for heart disease in women.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
I'm having a vision of when I'm sitting at the gym or like working out at the gym, yeah. And I see these young girls like 20 years old, and sometimes they look at you, they peer at you, and you know, I've got like the little menopause belly, and I just want to say to them, like, just you wait till you have two children, you have an autoimmune disease, like, and you're going through menopause. Cause it is, it's hard. I think yes. It's hard enough to have an inflammatory condition and then drop it on top. It's a bit of a roller coaster. So, when people walk into your office who have spondyloarthritis or another inflammatory, disease, is there a different way that you approach treatment?
Yeah. Great question. Yeah. And the changes you mentioned are real, right? And so it's so hard to see, you know, sometimes I actually refer my patients to see nutrition or lifestyle medicine. And it's really hard to really get or trust a nutritionist that you're referring patients to who really understand the unique challenges that midlife women face, right? And so the approach I usually take is really having a better understanding of the autoimmune condition and its disease course, right? Because if we truly understand it from the disease perspective, and also the woman in front of you who's telling her story that's, you know, very personal, then we have a broader kind of mindset in helping these women with autoimmune conditions such as spondyloarthritis. So the understanding that the symptoms are not just the classic ones, right? And a common story and narrative I hear from women is, you know, I saw someone for my symptoms. I thought that this was a perfect time to bring it up. But unfortunately, I felt disappointed at the end of the visit because I did not feel heard, or I often felt dismissed. And so that is also one of those, you know, common stories that I hear. And unfortunately, it's because, again, of that lack of education among the medical community on what really the symptoms could be, right, related to menopause. So, they may not be the classically known symptoms that spondyloarthritis patients are experiencing. They may be more of the cluster that we talked about that are not so classically known and to be associated with menopause. And really, there are many treatment options to help women nowadays during this time. And so that's why I get so passionate about it, because, you know, we are in this new emerging space in the menopause world where no one should be suffering alone. There's so many options, whether it's prescription therapy, non-prescription therapy, hormonal versus non-hormonal, specific lifestyle changes that I can discuss, you know, with my patient, and really anyone can discuss with their healthcare provider. And so it really is also an exciting time in the field, because we are learning more and more about menopause in general, but also these specific populations and how they are affected by their perimenopause and menopause journey.
Yeah. And I would imagine a generation ago, just it wasn't discussed. It was never discussed in my house. Mm-hmm. But I imagine that was very typical. And now, like, everywhere you look, I might have a bias. someone going through this currently might have a bias to like be listening to the information. But, and I hear, is it Drew Barrymore? She's always talking about menopause. And she's always like, nobody tells us this stuff.
Yeah.
And so I'm grateful that I'm living right where I'm at. Wow. We were going to talk about diet in a little bit, but can we talk about like diet or lifestyle changes that you see maybe thematically?
Yes. Yes. And that's always good to address, right? Really with any type of visit, whether it's menopause related or not, because this really sets the foundation for prevention of chronic disease, right, in the future. But overall, for menopause in general, and those specifically who have autoimmune conditions or rheumatic, conditions, maintaining a healthy, well-balanced, non-inflammatory diet that is rich in plant-based sources is essential for one, keeping the inflammation down, but also helping managing the symptoms of menopause. So what that means is, because I was very generalized, so this includes, eating less ultra processed foods, less processed carbs, including, breads, pastas, potatoes, rice and dessert, all the good things that we know about. So those are unfortunately causing more inflammation in the body, and also less sugar and just refined sugars in general. Sugar also can increase inflammation. And when you are already experiencing the cluster of changes we mentioned earlier, your cortisol level, which is your stress hormone, tends to be higher at baseline. So you add more refined carbs and you add more refined sugars on top of that, then you really are causing this ultimate havoc, right, in your body. And so we want to prevent that with lifestyle. And as you know, too, we mentioned, the risk factors for heart disease in women, which is still, unfortunately, the number one cause of death in women living in the United States. And I can actually say that, too, that applies to women globally. So foods to include would be, increasing your fiber intake, your protein intake, fruits, vegetables, whole grains. So if you're thinking about increasing your lean protein, there are many options out there, such as fish, chicken, tofu, lentils. I just had that for lunch, and you can really make that, and with that and with any recipes. And fats are okay, but choosing healthy fats are great. So that's avocados, nuts, seeds, flax seeds are all good calcium sources and not just good healthy fat sources.
That's a lot. And how about there's often a complaint. Let me ask you this first. A lot of these like greens drinks, how do you feel about those?
I think those are okay if you're using it as an adjunct. So you're integrating it into whole food sources, right? I practice what I preach when it comes to first, eat from whole food sources.
Right.
If you feel you're not getting enough from your daily intake of those food sources, then maybe that's where supplement might help, or these green drinks or smoothies might help as well. But if you're looking into that as your primary source of nutrients and minerals and all the good things, then that might not be the best for you.
Okay. And they don't have fiber, which is like one of the top things we need. And then on the right, we often hear women going through perimenopause or menopause. They go to the gym. You go to the gym. You spend 4 hours a week in the gym, and you can't lose a pound. Is there? And I've heard cortisol or different, but is there some general guidelines of like? I think we all struggle with it, right? Your body shape starts to change and you have to deal with it. I'm struggling to deal with it, but what can we do, or what should we be doing? Like, should we be cardioing or yoga? What's the...
Yeah, no, thanks for bringing that up, because this is one of those common concerns I also hear about in practice. So in particular, belly fat or central weight gain is a common concern. And so I tell my patients that there is about a 12 to 15 pound weight gain, just you entering midlife without changing anything, right? And that is affected by, you mentioned cortisol earlier, but also the hormonal fluctuations in perimenopause and the deficiency of estrogen and testosterone that happens in menopause and postmenopause. And so when you start losing your steroid hormones, your sex hormones, you can, one, decrease lean muscle mass and increase your fat mass and fat distribution. So the distribution of fat happens to be, you know, around the belly area, unfortunately, and that is also tied with high cortisol levels, your stress hormone. And so how to, one, you know, look at this in a positive lens is, one, give yourself a little bit more grace and compassion during this time, because there's so many changes that are happening, both physically, right, emotionally, mentally. And so it's always important to provide, you know, that grace for yourself that, yes, this is, you know, aging. There are physical effects of aging that we cannot change. But also, what can we do differently, right, from what we're already used to and doing? And I think that's where that personal kind of motivation and intervention start to happen. And so I do encourage my patients to, one, focus on strength training or resistance training, actually, and integrating that into their cardiovascular or cardio exercises. And the schedule I give, or an example I give, is, you know, 2 to 3 days a week for 30 minutes each time, you can incorporate some type of resistance or strength training for yourself. And all the other days could be whatever you like. So pick an activity that you enjoy doing the most. If that's pickleball because it's, you know, an excuse to see your friends, if it's running because you're part of the running club, great. Do something that's sustainable, that's for you, and that's your personal me time, right? And so we always have to remind ourselves of that too. And with the muscle building, because I mentioned earlier, as you lose your hormones, there tends to be a decrease in lean muscle mass. We need to feed these muscles, right? We need to build the muscles by providing the essentials or the building blocks for protein synthesis, and that is amino acids. And so increasing your lean protein intake by 1 gram per pound of body weight is a, you know, is something I recommend. But I know that sounds a lot and it can sound overwhelming for most. I always like to say, start, you know, in a more doable fashion. So if you're eating 3 meals a day, maybe incorporate 30 grams of protein for each meal. And an example of that is 4 ounces of chicken has about 30 to 35 grams of protein. So that's great. And then maybe if you add some eggs or lentils or tofu with that, that can also increase your protein. And so, again, it doesn't have to be so mind-boggling. And at the end of the day, you might not, you know, you might just feel defeated and might feel overwhelmed. So incorporate it and gradually increase as you go.
Yeah. And there's a big difference between the lean proteins and I don't know what you call them, like the not so lean proteins. and I've seen people fall into the trap of protein. Mm-hmm. Broader, more broadly, and then it complicates things.
Yeah, that's true. And that's there is a difference between the two categories. So like saturated fats, for example, right, can be smoked meats, processed meats, which are not as great for us. And so I always say, if you're eating healthily majority of the week, so 5-6 days of the week, and you have that one day where you're gonna, you know, have a date night with your partner and eat what you want to eat off the menu, I think that's totally fine. And so it's a good reminder that we're still humans. We like to enjoy a few things that are not as good, but if we're not eating it as consistently, and that's where the balance is happening.
Yeah, I think date night and the day you get your treatment, if you get treatment. First,
that is awesome.
I always stop and get ice cream on my way home. every time. So, okay. So let's get bone density.
Yes.
Let's talk about that. How do we protect ourselves?
Yeah, that's a great question. So bone health is very important in midlife women's health. And the reason for that is estrogen is a big part of our overall bone health status. So as we lose our estrogen, there is an associated accelerated bone loss that happens even before you achieve your last menstrual period. So even before entering menopause. So this starts in perimenopause. And that is just one factor, right? There are other factors for decreased bone density, including having a family history of osteoporosis, being on a steroid treatment for an autoimmune condition for long periods of time can also affect your bone health. So being on other biologic medications can also decrease bone density and bone mass. And having a father or mother with a hip fracture also is contributory to your bone health risk factor. So there's a lot of factors that affect your overall bone health, right? And your risk for osteoporosis. And so this is really the time to, one, discuss with your healthcare provider about those risk factors, including having an autoimmune condition and using oral steroids and other medications that could potentially decrease your bone density, because the conversation will hopefully include offering you some type of baseline bone density screening. And we typically use the DEXA for that. So it's not an invasive test at all. It's similar to an X-ray, but has about 10, 12 fold less radiation associated with it. And it calculates your bone density, which is in the metric of what we call the lowest T-score, in three anatomical sites. And so that could be your low back, which is your vertebra or your spine. It could be your hip, and it could be your wrist. And so the technician will measure that out. The testing or screening takes about 20 to 30 minutes or so. And that is one good test to offer women who have these risk factors even before they are 65 years old, because that used to be the guideline that this major kind of task force has endorsed, you know, offer bone mineral density screening to women 65 years or older. But now things are changing. We know that women are breaking bones even before 65 years because we're not intervening at the right time and we're not screening at the right time. And so that's a big deal in menopause care as well.
Interesting. Was the baseline for 65 set because they've traditionally looked at men?
Yeah, great question. So this baseline screening for men actually is 70 years. And then for women was 65. I think just as, you know, science evolves, there are just newer emerging studies that osteoporosis, that support osteoporosis as being this silent disease. So by the time we diagnose it, people are already developing or sustaining a fracture. So this is where the guidelines changed. And, you know, that based on population data, how do we screen and potentially intervene sooner before right. they're actually already breaking a bone? So that's where that change happened.
Yeah. I mean, it's a little bit like how spondylitis has shifted, mm-hmm. right? We went from, you had to have radiographic evidence. Mm. And that was until 2018 was like one of the primary factors in diagnosing. Now we have the non-radiographic mm-hmm. version, which a lot of people have. Mm-hmm. And they get the right medicine, they may prevent
right.
from having that problem. So, okay, so that's bone density. Mm-hmm. How is insurance about paying for bone density testing?
Yeah, that's a great question. It definitely varies. It depends on the associated diagnosis that your healthcare provider or physician is associating it with, the order with. So that will be something I would recommend. You can call an insurance representative to ask if a bone density screening, at least getting a baseline, is covered. If not, it's usually in the low 100s, as an
Okay.
out-of-pocket cost.
That's not horrendous,
Yeah.
right? Okay, let's move on to the heart. Talk a little bit about it, but what else do we need to know?
Yeah, another big area.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I alluded to this earlier. So when you lose your estrogen, inflammation tends to go up, right? And we already know women with autoimmune conditions already have that inflammatory process going on. And we also know, based on one, the Women's Health Initiative, so that big landmark study that was published back in the early 2000s, and that really just rocked the menopause world. But there have been studies that have emerged from that, as well as others, really in the last, I would say, 22 years, that support the notion that, estrogen tends to be cardioprotective. So when you start losing your estrogen, your risk for blood pressure goes up, your risk for cholesterol changes go up. In particular, the ones that are more specific to women are cardiac or heart biomarkers called lipoprotein A and apolipoprotein B. And so those are lab tests that you can talk to your healthcare provider about, especially if you're bad cholesterol types, and I put that with quotations because can't really describe it any better than that. So that would be your LDL cholesterol. If that is high, if your triglycerides are high, then that's when I would recommend adding those specific heart biomarkers to test out. Because the understanding is the higher those biomarkers, the risk for plaque formation in the blood vessels that support your heart, right, that supply blood to the heart, can potentially calcify over time and also rupture, causing a heart attack, right? So that
Yeah.
is something that's very specific for women. And I also want to address with your viewers and listeners that one, there are traditional risk factors for heart disease, like your hypertension or high blood pressure, I mentioned earlier, cholesterol, having obesity, being overweight, smoking, all those we commonly know about, right? The common sense one. However, there are also non-traditional risk factors for heart disease that are more specific for women. And the ones that you may not know about or may not even have heard of are one, having PCOS, polycystic ovarian syndrome, having had what we call a hypertensive disorder of pregnancy. So if you've been told you've had preeclampsia in the past, that actually is a risk factor for heart disease in the future. Having had gestational diabetes also increases your risk for insulin resistance and type 2 diabetes by sevenfold, which is a risk factor for heart disease. And so a lot of these, newer modifiers, but also emerging risk factors are being talked about now when it comes to women's heart health in general, not just specifically to those who have autoimmune conditions.
Yeah, and because we're going to air during Women's
Nice.
History Month or International Women's Month, I can't remember what it's exact, but I remember last year I did a bunch of research on Bernadine Healy, who was the first
Oh my gosh.
female director of the NIH, right? And she's the one that brought forward the Women's Health Initiative, which is what blew up menopause and women's heart
That's right.
condition, like risk and everything. So she gets a shout out. We like her. Talk to me about how do you feel about alcohol during menopause? Or in
Yeah.
general, I guess, or maybe let's stick to menopause.
Well, it can be applied across all that, right? So Yeah, so another great question. So alcohol tends to be a trigger for what we call vasomotor symptoms, which is just a fancy name for hot flashes and night sweats. And so if you are realizing that when you have a glass of wine with dinner, your sleep might be interrupted that evening, then it potentially is related to the alcohol intake, right? And we also now are learning that alcohol, specifically more than 3 alcoholic drinks per week, can also increase your risk for breast cancer. And so that's where it's being talked about now. And we know to date that about 33% of breast cancers are due to lifestyle alone, and that includes alcohol intake. And so I always say everything in life we do in moderation, right? And so too much alcohol can be bad, not just for the hot flashes, but it can also be bad for the heart as well as the risk for breast cancer.
Wow. Okay, so let's move on. Individualized hormone therapy, mm-hmm. especially in the context of autoimmune or chronic disease, does that help manage symptoms? What's your thought there?
Yeah, great question. It's so, how do I explain this? It is one of those realms, right, in the menopause space where we definitely need more data. We need to study women who have autoimmune conditions specifically and treatment options to help manage their symptoms. So I am going to generalize my answer, okay, and then hopefully end with a more specific answer to your question. So overall, we know that menopausal hormone therapy is the most effective option to help manage symptoms related to menopause. And so specifically those estrogen deficiency related ones like hot flashes and night sweats, right? But we also know that we can use menopausal hormone therapy for prevention of osteoporosis. So hopefully maintain bone mass or even reverse it in a positive way and gain and have bone gains, right? And so this is where we have one limited data on specifics of will hormone menopausal hormone therapy increase the symptoms related to these autoimmune conditions? Will it potentially, you know, worsen joint pain, for example? And I think, you know, from what I'm seeing clinically and based on anecdotal experience, it can vary. So there are some autoimmune disorders where their symptoms do flare up on estrogen, while others may actually mitigate those symptoms. And estrogen tends to be not just cardioprotective, but also anti-inflammatory. And so this can also help, hopefully, in the, you know, the individualization of menopausal hormone therapy can help symptoms that's related to inflammation, like joint pain I mentioned. So this is more of like a discussion that happens case by case. And there are certain contraindications to menopausal hormone therapy. So what that means is women who've had a history of stroke and heart attack are not good candidates for menopausal hormone therapy, especially if we know that they already have significant heart disease burden. Okay.
Okay.
And so the risk for hormone therapy, or the risks outweigh the benefits of initiating menopausal hormone therapy. So that's one. And then there's also this, what we call window of opportunity, also known as the timing hypothesis, where menopausal hormone therapy, if started or initiated within 10 years of menopause, overall decreases the risk for a cardiovascular event like stroke or heart attack. And so that is when it is the safest to initiate it in women who don't have known heart disease or have never had a heart attack or stroke. And to add to that, there are different formulations of estrogen. You probably are familiar with the patch, the gel, the spray, and those are called transdermal estrogen formulations. and how they are different from oral estrogen formulations is that transdermal don't go through the liver. They actually bypass the liver. So they don't stimulate the production of inflammatory markers and clotting factors. So overall, we do consider them safer formulation to use or to offer women who are at higher risk for inflammation or a cardiovascular event.
Okay. So with that, and I may be wildly off, but there was a period in time where hormone therapy was there were issues with it. And I think I'd be interested for our listeners to know like the safety side of it, because I think it's something that I've talked to a few women who've carried it forward and said, well, I would never try it because it's not safe. Mm-hmm. But then my doctor's like, no. I'd love your thoughts on that. Because like you said, people should have access to things and I think it's important.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. So the common, I don't really consider them myths, but the common topics of discussion I have with my patients is, you know, what is my risk of breast cancer on menopausal hormone therapy, right? That's a common one that gets brought up. So we know, and this is also based on Women's Health Initiative or WHI data, that women who don't need to take a progestin or progesterone because they no longer have a uterus, maybe they've had a hysterectomy and can safely take estrogen by itself, actually showed that those women taking just menopausal estrogen by itself overall did not have an increased risk for breast cancer. In fact, they had a lower risk for breast cancer. Compared to women who took both estrogen plus progestin or progesterone in combination. And so again, that's for women who have a uterus and need to protect their uterus from estrogen, they need to take the combination therapy. And that is the group of women that showed a slightly increased risk of breast cancer. Overall, the absolute risk is fairly low. And again, breast cancer risk is multifaceted, right? It can be literally anything, age being the biggest risk factor. And so compared to those anything and to those other factors, overall menopausal hormone therapy does not have an absolutely high risk for breast cancer, although it's the exposure to that progestin or progesterone that can proliferate the breast tissues. And that is where that slightly associated breast cancer risk is coming from. So it's not menopausal estrogen that stimulates or proliferates the breast tissue, but it's that exposure to the synthetic progestins. So that's one that I talk about with my patients. And the risk for a blood clot is another topic I discuss with my patients. And what I mentioned earlier is that there are safer formulations that have a lower risk for just blood clotting in general, right? Because the transdermal options are not stimulating those clotting factors or inflammatory markers. And so this is where also, depending on your goals and your preference, the patch, the gel, or spray are safer formulations and have overall lower risk for blood clotting. And there are also what we call bioidentical menopausal hormone therapy. And that really is just a fancy term to utilize to define, you know, that the estrogen you're taking has the same chemical structure as the estrogen that your ovaries used to produce, basically. And that is estradiol is the bioidentical estrogen, and micronized progesterone is the bioidentical progestogen or progesterone. So that would be a bioidentical combination that you can discuss with your healthcare provider that also shows less what we call thrombogenic effects. So less risk for blood clotting because of its bioidentical properties.
Awesome. Okay. This is like, I'm learning so much. I hope our listeners are too. And I thought I knew stuff. I want to hit three more topics before we let you go. One is we're going to do fatigue, sex, and anxiety in no particular order.
Yeah. Yeah. Those are really hard. you know, very challenging concerns to discuss, especially fatigue. I think fatigue is a very complex symptom because it can really be caused by many things, unfortunately. And so this is where, you know, really taking a deep dive into your history and your associated symptoms with a fatigue can make a difference. And so, for example, fatigue can be caused by sleep interruptions, right? So if you're not sleeping well at night because of maybe hot flashes that are waking you up or maybe night sweats that you're dealing with, you're not going to feel great the next day. You're going to feel tired. You may actually feel drained already as you're waking up to your alarm clock. You may feel a little bit more brain fog, right? Lack of focus, just because you didn't sleep well. And sleep is huge in many ways. I joke around that even if you came to me and we talked about your sexual health, I'm going to ask about your sleep because it is so much interrelated with our entire kind of entire symptomatology when it comes to perimenopause and menopause. And so that's one thing that I ask, right, is sleep. And if there's any hot flashes and night sweats, another, category I ask is about any underlying sleep disorders. So are you waking up at night gasping for air or breath, concerning for sleep apnea? If you have a partner in bed and has noticed you snore at night or you're waking yourself up because you snored yourself up, then that would be concerning for an underlying sleep disorder. And fatigue is a big component of underlying sleep disorder, like sleep apnea. And restless leg syndrome is also another condition to think about. And that is a condition that involves this feeling of uneasiness in your lower extremities that prompts you to get out of bed. And usually that getting out of bed can help ease the uneasiness. Sometimes it presents as itching of your legs as well. So that's another cause of sleep interruptions that could potentially cause fatigue. And a sleep study or a referral to a sleep specialist would really be eye-opening, especially if your healthcare provider is concerned about you having an undiagnosed sleep disorder. And then fatigue can also be related to just too much inflammation, right, in the body. And so this is where our lifestyle habits, optimizing our nutrition, increasing our happy hormones like serotonin with physical activity and movement really can help. One, increase, you know, support our mental health, right? But also can help mitigate fatigue. So there's a lot of components of that. And then there's the zebras of the potential causes of fatigue. And that could be adrenal insufficiency. So when you're not producing enough, you know, either sex hormones or also steroid hormones, then that could also potentially present as fatigue. So it's really a multifaceted intervention as well as discussion with your healthcare provider.
Yeah, we did an episode with, I think Dr. Cordy, he's Belgian, and we did it on fatigue. He has spondyloarthritis and he's spent his life researching fatigue in spa patients. It was very interesting around the fatigue. He had mentioned the fatigue shows up as it on the back end of an event, of an inflammatory event. And then it's a downstream follow-on effect. And I think there's so, like you said, there's so many reasons around fatigue.
Yeah.
I just took a nap before we got on. I've been at my desk since like 7:30 and I was like,
wow,
oh, 20 minutes. Okay. So, should we do sex or anxiety?
Yeah. You get to choose.
All right. Let's do sex, sexual wellness.
Yes. Yeah. That's a good one because I mentioned earlier that there are estrogen receptors that are found everywhere, right? They're found all over our body, including our genitourinary system, which includes the bladder, the vagina, the vulva. And those are important organs to think about, not just for urinary incontinence, which I'm sure you've had a podcast on, but also...
No, it's a good one. We should.
That's awesome. Well, I have a lot of contacts for that if you
want to connect
with them. Yeah. So there are estrogen receptors that are found in your vagina and your vulva. And once you start losing your estrogen, those receptors are no longer being stimulated. And so that's, you know, the symptom cluster that I mentioned includes not just feeling dry down there, because estrogen increases what we call lubrication and also prevents dryness, right? But it also can increase what we call collagen production. So that helps with elasticity and strength of your pelvic floor muscles, as well as the tissues that support the vagina and the vulva. So once you start losing all of that, you will start experiencing symptoms. And I mentioned dryness, but pain with intercourse is also very common to hear. UTI-like symptoms like burning with urination, frequency, urgency, even if you don't actually have bacteria in your urine or even have a urinary tract infection, it's common to experience this as you lose your estrogen. Because the same tissues of the vagina also make up the same tissues of the base of the bladder called the trigone, as well as the urethra. And so that's why it happens, all at once, unfortunately. And unfortunately, these symptoms also progressively get worse. So without any treatment or without any vaginal estrogen formulation, symptoms do get worse as we live, well into our postmenopausal years. And so there are so many options out there for what we call genitourinary syndrome of menopause. That's the constellation of symptoms that happen when you lose your estrogen, affecting the vagina and the vulva and the bladder. And it is safe and effective. And these vaginal estrogen formulations don't increase blood levels of estrogen at all. In fact, they just act locally. So even in breast cancer survivors, we can offer vaginal estrogen formulations, especially if they've tried everything else and things are still an issue for them. So that's an important one to talk to your healthcare provider about, as well as get a pelvic exam, because it could also be something else. It could also be related to an inflammatory skin disorder of the vulva, like lichen sclerosis, and that is typically associated with autoimmune conditions either, like thyroid disease. And so a good, gynecologist or a good healthcare provider should have that in their brains to rule out other forms of causes that may present similarly to lack of estrogen in the vagina and the bladder.
Oh, interesting. So the localized estrogen, mm-hmm. with somebody that's, you would go to your provider, your OBGYN, okay.
Right. Yeah. I wish it was over the counter. I wish there was a big billboard on highways that say every woman experiencing menopausal and perimenopausal symptoms should be on vaginal estrogen, because overall it is safe to use. And it's not just for sexual health. I don't care if you're not having sex at all. It doesn't mean you can't use vaginal estrogen. It's not just for sex. It's also for prevention of recurrent urinary tract infections, which is also associated with lack of estrogen. So it's for overall genital urinary health.
How interesting. Increasing time is because, good Lord.
You and I could talk literally about this for hours.
Yes. And we did talk with, there's a woman, Iris Zink. She's a nurse practitioner in Michigan. We did, I think, two episodes with her on sexual wellness with spa. Mm-hmm. And we got into some deep discussions. But and I think her response was, well, if you can, continue with having sex for as long as you can. And okay. Anxiety is our last topic, thankfully.
Yeah. So anxiety, as well as depression, actually, so overall mental health in general, can or are common also manifestations of perimenopause actually is where I'm seeing this a little bit more. So women who've had a, you know, previous anxiety, depression, and maybe were taking some type of antidepressants or anti-anxiety medications are vulnerable to developing also worsening anxiety as they transition into their midlife years. And women who've had postpartum, you know, depression as well are at risk for developing anxiety and depression in, well into their midlife years. And so this is where it's really important to support women as they transition into perimenopause and menopause, because anxiety can just be out of the blue. It, you know, it's not necessarily triggered by something huge or by, you know, a big event that happened personally or around them. It could be just a random, you know, anxious thought, or it could be a random panic attack without having had any panic attacks in the past. And this can be accompanied by, you know, heart racing, fluttering, heart palpitations. And my understanding or my theory behind this is, especially in perimenopause, where I see this the most, actually, the fluctuating levels of estrogen, and in particular, that change or delta in the estrogen concentration, so the dip, can irritate the electrical conduction system of the heart, and that can cause the actual like heart symptoms. So there are so many kind of theories around this, and unfortunately I wish we can say that, you know, the mechanism of why this happens has been strongly supported, but till this day we are still a little perplexed. But unfortunately, I do commonly hear this, especially around perimenopause. And so the typical conversation that you might have with your healthcare provider may include, well, let's just start you on some type of antidepressant. So that's like an SSRI or SNRI, right? But then you're sitting in front of your healthcare provider and saying, well, I am not depressed. This is something, you know, this is something that's new for me. This is something that's never happened before. I don't have a history of anxiety or depression, but all of a sudden I am feeling this way. And this is where, again, there's a big association, a large association between estrogen fluctuating levels of it specifically and the worsening anxiety.
Interesting. And I'm going to ask one more question and then we're but we should definitely do a follow-up. as you go through perimenopause, I mean, the estrogen goes up and down over time. Yeah. And it can go for as long as 10 years.
Yes. Yes, it can. It can. So, and this is where, again, it varies, right? And actually I meant to mention this earlier, but we know based on the study of women's health across the nation, also known as the SWAN study, that women of color, in particular Black women and Hispanic women, tend to have an earlier menopause onset, but also the longest duration of symptoms. And so this can vary among women based on your race, right? Ethnic background, based on your health history, on your lifestyle, medications that you're taking. So all of those. So that can definitely vary as far as how long will these symptoms last. But you're absolutely right to say that in perimenopause, you're dealing with the up and down swinging of your hormones, and that includes estrogen and progesterone. And why women are the most symptomatic is because of that dip in concentration of estrogen. So that delta, that change. And so in perimenopause, when you're still having regular periods, you might actually feel okay, right? You're just living your life, doing your thing. But when you start skipping periods, that's when you are more frequently exposed to that lack of estrogen, the decrease in concentration. And that's where symptoms start to become more noticeable and can really affect your day-to-day activities. So that's a real deal. That's exactly how I explain perimenopause in a one-liner.
Yeah, it's, I mean, I have been experiencing, and I've called friends and asked them, like, what is going on? Like, all I do is cry, and it's 3 days, and I just am miserable. And then all of a sudden you're like, oh, it's been 6 months, and yep, here I am again. and then it dissipates for a while, yeah, and then you lose your mind again. No, it's an insane time, but it's, again, we're lucky to have the information we have now. So last question, I promise. This has been amazing. What if you could solve one thing for women about menopause, what would it be? Moonshot.
Oh my gosh. Well, I don't know if I can solve anything around menopause, but what I can provide as a kind of a take-home message, I guess, for your listeners would be that knowledge is power, right? So having this conversation in your podcast is very powerful, because knowing more about the stages of midlife and really understanding your symptoms that are unique to you and what you're experiencing, then we can, as your healthcare providers, as a medical community, hopefully can come up with the many options that are available for you and your specific symptoms. So finding a menopause certified provider in your area will be the best way to find a menopause specialist. If you feel that you need to see one, maybe your primary care provider is a good resource for you, and you know, we can leave it at that. But if you feel that you need to see someone specifically to discuss your perimenopause and menopause journey, then the menopause.org webpage will have resources for you, one, for just understanding what's going on, and two, helping you find a menopause certified provider. So I want everyone to know that there's a lot of information out there, right? Both credible and not so credible. And when we become our best advocates for ourselves, when we're really increasing our knowledge and reading, listening to podcasts like this, maybe checking out a book from the library on menopause, this is where we become the best versions of ourselves, because we know more, right? We become more knowledgeable. We can best prepare for the stages of midlife and not have to worry, is this something else, when you know more? Right.
Amazing. On that note, I'm going to thank you for your time. And we'd love to have you back as we move through the next stages of life. But thank you so much, Dr. Moreno. This has been wonderful.
Yeah, thank you so much, Jill.
SpondyCast was made possible by donations from the Spondylitis Association of America's individual members and our show's corporate sponsor, AbbVie. Since our founding in 1983, the Spondylitis Association of America has been the face, voice, and leading nationwide nonprofit educating, empowering, and advocating for people living with spondyloarthritis. Through our extensive work with patients, the medical community, and partners, we provide information and resources to help people impacted by the disease live better lives and champion research to find a cure.